Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to yet another edition of ITE 1, Class 1, Chapter 8, Part 2. Last week we introduced you to all kinds of things. I'm not going to go for a review because we've got a lot of material to cover. So before we start on Section 8.6, which is Identify Standards Organisations, has anyone got any questions about the material we covered last week? And again, I apologise for this horrible weed eater. So you're all au fait with the material, everything's cool, it's wonderful. Okay, now I wouldn't be spending much time on the standardising, on the Standards Organisations section, mainly because it's lots of guff, but there's an exam question involved, so I'll run over it very, very quickly and then we'll just move on. Standardizing technology ensures that the devices you use will be compatible with other devices using the same technology. You're now familiar with a number of standards, IEEE 1394 for FireWire, IEEE 1284 for parallel communication, and IEEE 802.3 for Ethernet, which is what we introduced you to last week. So take a good look at the diagram for 8.6 and learn and be aware of the organizations which define these standards. There's the CCIT, IEEE, and that's been around for a while, actually, the IEEE, quite a long while, in fact. The ISO, and that's the inventor of the Open Systems Interconnect OSI model, which we'll discuss shortly. The IAB, the IEC, ANSI, which you will have seen in conjunction with DOS and other things. The TIA/EIA, now I mention this one because that's where the exam question is, and that evolved after the US telephone system deregulation in 1984, before this, owners use proprietary standards, so you need to know that for your exam. All right, that's all I'm going to say about standards. The information is there for you to be aware of in the diagram 8. For the section 8.6. All right, back to good old Ethernet. Now, what did I say the Ethernet standard was, people?
IEEE 802.3.
Phantasmagorical, yes? Okay. 802.3, and the wireless standard for Ethernet is 802.11, and we'll be talking about a bit about both of those in this section. Now, we already have talked about categories of cable and that kind of thing, so this all fits in with what they have here. It's a bit repetitive, so I'll do my best not to repeat myself too much. Okay, does anyone remember what the IEEE 802.3 specifies in terms of the way it carries data? It's a great big long horrible acronym, and it's the way that it does its access control.
I can't remember.
No, it's a CMSA, Carrier Sense Multiple Access with Collision Detection. And so it's a good idea to be aware of what that is and does, about how it listens for the clear line and how it employs its jamming algorithm if there is a collision. So you don't learn what it's slightly different when using wireless. It's collision avoidance, not collision detection, which acts in a slightly different way, but you're not asked to learn that at this point. But that's what it specifies. It's the first thing you need to know about the Ethernet standard. It specifies the CMSA CD access control. Okay. Now, there's a number of advantages to Ethernet technologies. The cable is easy to install and inexpensive compared to fibre optic and coax. And the cables are thin and flexible and therefore easier to handle. And the equipment and cables are easy to upgrade. But one of the big disadvantages of Ethernet is that there's a maximum segment length throughout of 100 metres or 328 feet, which can be a pain when you're trying to install in large areas. It's amazing how much meterage or footage of cable it takes to put around buildings, for instance. And the cables are more susceptible to EMI and RFI than coax or fibre. Now, again, we introduced you to the categories last week, and we talked about Category 3, Category 5 and 5E, and Category 6. Well, sometimes you'll hear these things referred to as 10 base T, 100 base T, and 1000 base T. Now, 10 base T has a speed of 10 megabits per second and is Cat 3 cable, which is the stuff you find that your telephone uses. It's pretty thin and very noisy and not really very useful compared to our more modern cables. The 100 base TX, of course, goes at 100 megabits per second, and 5 and 5E are what it uses. It's also called fast Ethernet, so sometimes you'll hear 100 base T, referred to as fast Ethernet. Now, the T, by the way, stands for twisted pair, if you want to know that. Now, 1000 base T is also called gigabit Ethernet, and it uses Category 6 cable, and that's becoming more and more in use. You'll find that many motherboards and devices now are gigabit Ethernet devices, and if you have the network infrastructure to take it, you can have really good live streaming of videos and conferences and stuff like that. So you'll also might hear terms like 10 base FL, 100 base FX, and 1000 base SX and LX, and they're fiber optic Ethernet technologies. So if you run across those and you think, oh, what the hell is that? That's what it is, it's fiber optic. There's a good table that summarises all of this in 8.7.1, so have a look at that. Okay, wireless Ethernet standards. And that's IEEE 802.11. There are four standards we're going to look at, A, B, G, and N. Now, standard A has a maximum speed of 54 Mbps and a maximum range of 45.7 meters or 150 feet. And that's all things being equal, of course. All kinds of things can affect that. Noise, interference, where the access point is located. All these things can interfere with a wireless speed and performance. Now, 802.11a uses the 5 gigahertz frequency range. It's important because there's only one standard with which that's compatible. Now, 802.11b has a maximum speed of only 11 megabits per second, but it has a maximum range of 91 meters or 300 feet, and it uses the 2.4 gigahertz rather than the 5 gigahertz frequency. 802.11G has a maximum speed of 54 Mbps, just like A, but it has the same maximum range that that B standard has, and it uses the same frequency as B, and because it uses the same frequency, it's backward compatible with B. So if you've got a router that will take G and you put a B device on it, it will work. That B device will only operate as fast as it can go. Now, the standard that we're all using now, that most of us are using, is N. That has a maximum speed of 10 times, which is 540 megabits per second, maximum range of 250 meters or 984 feet, and again, actually it uses both frequencies. It uses the 2.4 gig and 5 gigahertz frequencies, which means it's backwards compatible with G, B, and A, because of course A is the only other standard which uses the 5 gigahertz range. And the big advantage with N now is that we're seeing broadband devices, which are called dual band, which means they run on both frequencies at once, which really does enhance your wireless performance. Now, before we go on to layered models, does anyone have any questions about any of this?
How would you be able to find out what your wireless modem is?
It will usually say, in the specs of the modem when you buy it, it will say it's a G or an N. You will see something like 802.11N router or G router or something like that, so it tells you which standard. Now, the other way you can tell is when you are on wireless, it will tell you what speed you're going at. So that's likely to tell you also, if you've got a good signal strength, which kind of modem you've got. For instance, if all you can get out of it is 54 Mbps, then you've probably got a G, so that also will tell you. Of course, you can look at the properties of your network interface card and device manager and see what it is, because that will also have, your wireless card will also have a standard attached to it.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
And welcome to Kim and Terry. Okay. Data models, wonderful data models, sorry. Oh, I do love this. Okay, because they actually really, once you know how they work, make it so much easier to troubleshoot things, especially when we talk about the OSI model, which we will in a while, because it's industry standard and it's across all platforms, which means whatever network you're using, you can apply that layering to the network and troubleshoot it. Okay, an architectural model is a common frame of reference for explaining internet communications and for developing communication protocols. It separates the functions of protocols into manageable layers. Each layer performs a specific function in the process of communicating over a network. The TCP/IP model has four layers and was invented by the US Defense Department in the 80s. It describes the TCP/IP protocol, which is the dominant protocol for transferring data over the internet, and that also is a test alert. A TCP/IP protocol is the dominant one. The ISO developed the OSI Open Systems Interconnect model in the late 80s, and it's in 7 layers and represents a really big step forward in terms of the interoperability of networks. As I said, it's non-platform specific. Now, in each model, data travels down the layers from the top to the bottom when it is sent, and the information is added as it goes. Then that information is stripped away when it goes back up the layers from the bottom to the top when it is received at its destination. So in both models, when it's sent, it goes down the layers, and when it was received, it goes up the layers. So it's the first thing that you need to remember. Okay, let's have a quick look at the four layers of TCP/IP before we move on to OSI, because OSI is so much more interesting and it describes a whole lot better what is actually happening. But you need to know both, because sometimes you still need to deal with the TCP/IP model. Now, layer 4 of the TCP/IP is the application layer, and that applies to both. Both TCP/IP and OSI models, the top layer is called the application layer. Now, from the notes, this provides services to your chosen programs, such as email and web browsing. Protocols include HTTP, of course, which is web browsing, FTP for file transfer, DNS for domain name service, HTML, and SMP for when you're sending your email. Layer 3 of the TCP/IP model is called the transport layer, and it specifies which application requested or is receiving data through the specific ports. Okay, so that's transport has to do with ports in both models. They're different numbered layers, but transport has to do with ports, among other things. That's something you need to remember when talking about either layered model. Information is broken into tiny segments for ease of transport, and that's what happens in both cases also. Here, there are two transport protocols you need to be introduced to, TCP and UDP. Now, TCP is the one that you mostly use when you send email, when you use the web, that kind of thing. Using a TCP, because what that does is that has a lot of error correction and acknowledgement built into it. So every packet that is sent has to be acknowledged that it's been received. Okay, I've got it, you can send the next one, that's cool. Which is all very well for low bandwidth technologies, but if you're using things like voice and video, you need something that is going to be perhaps a little less in terms of acknowledgement, but a little more flexible, and UDP is that protocol. Now, what that does is it's basically fire and forget. Like the post, you put your letter in and they'll do their best to get it to its destination, but it's not 100% guaranteed and it's not acknowledged. So you'll notice sometimes when you're on Skype, which of course uses UDP, that if there are too many people talking at once or you're doing something big, you can get a dropout. And that means that packets are actually being lost because they haven't reached their destination, and there's nothing at the destination saying, hey, I haven't got that packet, can you send it again? So it just goes into a black hole. So that's basically the difference between TCP and UDP. TCP is acknowledged data, UDP is unacknowledged. Okay, layer 2 of the TCP/IP model is the internet layer, and that's concerned with IP addressing and routing. And it's mostly about deciding the path that the data will take. And the protocols here include IP, which provides addressing information, which we've already learned about. And we also know what ICMP is about. Who can tell me one ICMP tool that we've used? We used a couple of them last week.
Anyone remember the machine?
We did two things on the command line. What did we do last week, folks?
Oh, one was ping and the other was trace.
Yeah, they're ICMP. So,
machine that goes bing.
Yeah, exactly.
One was ping and one was trace.
Yeah, they're both ICMP protocols. Okay, ICMP tools. Now, another protocol is RIP, which works between routers and expedites the path of the data. You don't really need to know about that in this course. And ARP, which defines the MAC address of a network device which has a known IP address. And also, you don't need to know anything more about ARP at this point. And layer 1 is the network access layer in the TCP/IP, and that's where MAC addressing and physical components of the network exist. The packaged data is given a frame and sent out through whichever media is being used, such as copper or fibre or radio waves. Okay, so there are four layers to the TCP/IP model. It's very simple, but it applies only to the TCP/IP suite of protocols.
I'm sorry, can you just run through them? There's application, transport, and I've forgotten.
I forget the names of them myself, actually, because I'm more addressed in internet and network.
Oh, yeah, application, transport, internet, network. Thank you.
Not a problem. And as I said, it's that you don't see those as much anymore because people tend to use. Yeah, no, that's the top layer. We're going top down. Okay. Right, OSI. Now, this has taken over because it expresses in much more detail, and as I said, in cross-platform, what happens to data on any network. So it's become the industry standard. A lot of technicians will work in that layer these days, actually most of them will, and with that, using that model. Now, usually, the higher layers have to do with software and the lower layers with hardware, usually. Now, the seven layers. Okay, if I send Elise an email, my message begins at layer 7, which is also called the application layer, just as it is in TCP/IP. Now, here, SMTP is used to start the process, and if I was using the standard port for SMP, which port would it be, people?
25?
Yes. I don't use 25 for mine. I use secure SMTP, but 25 is the standard port. Okay. Now, my message moves down to layer 6, which is the presentation layer, when formatting information is added. Okay. Now, at layer 5, the session layer, information is nicely ordered in readiness for transport. Now, notice how information is being added as we progress. This is called encapsulation, and that'll happen all the way through the process until my data is sent over to Elise. Right, at layer 4, which is the transport layer, my message gets broken up into tiny segments for orderly transport. And here, the port number of Elise's computer will be added, and because she'll receive my email via IMAP, the port will be what, people?
110.
That's POP. Anyone else? Wakey wakey, folks. 143. Okay, IMAP is 143. So that'll be added in this point because it's the destination port that the network is concerned with. It's got to know where to send it. Okay, there'll also be sequencing and acknowledgement info in there because we're using the TCP transport protocol. Okay, now that it's been decided what's being sent, we need to know where and how to send it. So that we've gone down the first three layers, application, presentation, session, and down to the transport layer. And by this point, my message has become data and it's all in tiny little bits all ready to be sent. Okay, at layer 3, the network layer, my segments are encapsulated into packets which contain the IP addressing information and also the message itself. And that'll map out the path my message will take via mine and all the other routers and infrastructure until it gets to over where Elise is. So layer 3 is all about routers and pathways. Now, at layer 2, the data link layer is where my packets are encapsulated into frames, and we've talked a little bit about frames before, which contain the MAC address of Elise's device, and also some header information. So, again, information is being added. So now we know what we're sending and where it's going to go. Now that it knows what to send and where to send it, the computer can pass it to layer 1, the physical layer. And in my case, that would be copper cabling. So now that the computer has decided what we're sending and where to send it, it can decide how to send it. And that's what the physical layer does. It's all about the media that we use to send the message. Okay, so are we all clear so far on what's happening to our data?
So up until this point, your data hasn't actually left your machine, your network, your whatever. It's sort of set itself up, but it hasn't actually gone.
Yes, it has. It's gone into the media. It's on its way now over to Elise's via whatever media I'm using. Like, it might be cable. In my case, it's copper cabling because I'm on DSL. But if I was using wireless, it would be radio waves. So it's on its way. It's been all set up and it's on its way over now. But it hasn't reached there yet. Once it reaches there, we're going to reverse the process.
So if Elise is on wireless, and there has to be a point somewhere along the line at one of the travel points where it has to change itself from cable to wireless.
Kate, this is a layered model, so the same principles. And really, what Kylie's describing here isn't something tangible, something that you can pick up and move around and put on the shelf and, you know, sort of plug in your computer and hide under the bed, etc. It's all principles. So what happens is that the principles that Kylie's talking about apply whether the connection is made over wireless or whether it's made over copper cable, coax cable, fibre optic, anything. So regardless of what the physical connections are between myself and the internet and Kylie and the internet, the principles of this, like the, you know, travelling down the layered model and discussing, I got distracted by a phone call there, but whatever layer you're up to at the moment, I think you're probably up to layer 4 or 5, I think, just judging by the conversation.
No, we're in layer 1. We're talking about media.
Oh, you're down to the physical layer.
Media, right? we're using.
Exactly.
Well, it doesn't matter what media we're using. It'll start again from layer 1.
Exactly. So this proves my point even more. Basically, that doesn't matter whether we're using radio waves as the media or the copper wire. Particularly, you know, like copper wire, there's always going to be some bits on a wire before it gets to an access point anyway, a wireless anyway. So this is all principles, and it can be applied to all the physical ways of transmitting data.
Okay, so say I was sending my email through cable, but Elise was on wireless. She would be receiving the message from me at layer 1, her layer 1, which is wireless. It doesn't matter that our actually media that we're using are different. The physical layer is all layer 1, and that's about the physical media that's used to transfer our data. So when Elise's network receives my message via layer 1, which in her case might be wireless, let's just say it is for the purposes of this exercise, the process reverses. First, the frame information is stripped away or de-encapsulated at layer 2, then the IP addressing information at layer 3, where the data has become packets again, followed by the port number and other transport information at layer 4. So as you can see, information that was added when it was being sent from my machine or encapsulated is now being stripped away or de-encapsulated at Elise's end. At layer 5, the information is sorted, and at layer 6, the message is formatted into something which can be read by Elise's email program at layer 7, the application layer. Now, so do you see what's happened here? I've sent Elise a message, and it's travelled down all through the 7 layers into the physical media, and then once she receives it, it travels up again from the physical back to the application layer. Any questions?
And a good analogy also would be to whether it's wireless or wired, is that Kylie could be sending that message from her Outlook Express email client. I could be reading it in Mozilla Thunderbird, because Outlook Express and Thunderbird, whilst they are different, work at the application layer and therefore adhere to all the same standards.
And that's what's so good about the OSI model. It doesn't matter what you're using, it applies to whatever's being used. Okay, now there are some mnemonics that will help you remember what the layers are. And the one I've just described to travelling the top down, application, all, presentation, people, session, seam, transport, to, network, need, data link, processing, physical. All people seem to need data processing. Well, actually we don't, but you know. And travelling up the layer, you could use please do not throw sausage pizza away. So we've got physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, and application. Okay, now there's a comparison in there in section 8.3 that you can look at to see which layers map to which. I'm not going to really talk about that too much. It's there in the diagram, and you can look at that. They try to do it again in the beginning of this section, but don't worry about that one. It's really too confusing. Okay, before we move on to 8.9 about configuring NICs and things, have we got any questions? Have I bamboozled you all? It does take a while, so if it seems like it's all as clear as mud at the moment, that's fine. It does take a while to understand it, and there isn't anything in the module exam on it, although you may receive something in the final, so it's a good thing to know. And it's also a good thing to know if you're going to be a techie, because that's what all techies use, is the industry standard, which is why I spent so much time on it. Okay, section 8.9, configuring an NIC and a modem. Okay, the good old network interface card, we're familiar with that. You need one to access the internet, of course. Whether you're using wireless or wired internet, you need one, and you need one for each interface. So you'll find these things, of course, either integrated onto your motherboard, or you can sit one in an expansion slot, or you can attach one externally through USB. And you might still also need to use a modem in desperate cases, although I'm not going to spend too much time on that stuff. It's in your notes. We'll talk more about how to configure the NIC, because it talks about configuring serial modems and things, and I don't know anyone these days who still uses one of those. But it's handy stuff to know and be a bit familiar with. So Let's talk about NICs. Right. We know that drivers communicate between the hardware and the OS, and that the best place to get the most up-to-date drivers is where, people?
On the manufacturer's website.
Yeah, remember that, folks. It's on the manufacturer's website. Yes, your hardware will come with drivers on a CD, but they may not be the most up-to-date ones. So it's the manufacturer's website that you approached for the latest and greatest. All right, now, when you're installing drivers, you need to, it's a good idea anyway, to disable your virus protection to avoid conflicts, and don't install more than one driver at a time, and close all other applications while you're doing it. And this will avoid possible conflicts. So those three things: disable your virus protection temporarily, of course, don't install more than one at a time, and make sure that that's all you're doing is installing that driver. Now, there are two ways to install your driver: from an executable that you downloaded from your manufacturer's site, and that will usually find where it needs to be installed and just go ahead and do it, or from the update driver feature in Device Mangler. Now, once you get into Device Mangler, you open your network adapters in the tree view and press enter on the network adapter you're updating. Go to the drivers tab in the resulting properties dialog box that you'll see there, and follow the bouncing ball, as Dr. McBride used to say. Follow the instructions. They're pretty obvious. Just like installing anything, you just follow the prompts. Now, you can check wireless adapter properties by clicking the network icon in your system tray. When you're connected to wireless, of course, your connection will show up in your system tray, and you can get into the properties through there. Or, of course, again, you can go through Device Mangler. Now, in XP, that's under Properties greater than Configure greater than Advanced. And in Vista and 7, you go to Properties, Configure, Advanced under the Network and Sharing Center. So there's one more step there in your Windows 7 or Vista, or just, as we tend to do, use the search box. Okay, so to install the driver, just download it from the manufacturer's site or use the feature in the Device Manager to do it that way. Is that clear as mud? Cool. Okay, now that the NIC drivers are installed, you have to connect to the network. And of course, you plug in your Ethernet cable into the back of the computer through the RJ45 and into the wall or into a router or into a connecting device. The next thing that you'd need to do, or a sighted person would do at least, is check the link lights on the NIC for activity. And the absence of these could mean that there's a faulty cable, a faulty port, or that the NIC itself is faulty. And that kind of thing tends to come up in exams as well, all about link lights. So just remember, although they're not a concern for us, they need to be known about. And absence of the lights means there's something wrong with those three things. It's a physical fault, either a cable, the NIC, or a port. Okay, then every successful connection needs the following. It needs the same protocol to be implemented between any two computers that communicate on the same network. Well, obviously, it's pretty obvious. It needs an IP address, and of course, this must be unique, as you know, to each device. And you can manually configure that or automatically assign it via what, people? What's the service we use to automatically assign IP addresses?
DHCP.
Yeah, DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. Yeah, that's what we use to assign automatically. Okay, of course, you need a MAC address. Each device has one of those, and it's a unique address that, unlike an IP address, is unchangeable and assigned by the manufacturer. You also need, for a successful connection, a default gateway address. Now, can anyone remember what we discussed about what the default gateway is?
Is that the address of your modem?
Usually the address of your router. Yes, it's the gateway between your internal network and the external part of your network. So that's why it's called the default gateway. Now, DNS. Can anyone remember what DNS is?
Any takers?
Domain service. I have it, but it's bouncing around in the marble cage.
I can see it's on the tip of your tongue there, John. A domain name service, which does what? What does it do?
Isn't that, that's the HTTP.
It resolves the domain names to IP addresses. So if you type in a URL with words such as www.lonsdalemedia.org, then it resolves that to the correct IP address. That's what DNS does. So in that dialog box, in this, for a successful connection, you need the proper DNS settings as well. And of course, you need a subnet mask. Now, all that is found under the TCP/IP properties of your network card. Now, in 7, you do search for TCP/IP and you should come up with it. Under Vista faster in 7, it's under TCPIP v4 at the moment. So you need to be looking under the properties of TCPIP v4, and there'll be a dialog, and you'll need your IP address, your default gateway, and DNS settings. So all those things are needed for a successful connection once you have connected to the network. Now, you can test your connectivity by using what, people? It's an ICMP command.
Ping.
Yes, and how do you find out what your IP address is? There's another command in the command line tool bag that we use to find out what that is, and it's what? We used it last week.
TRACERT.
No, what does that do? That's another ICMP command. That's a troubleshooting command. What does that do? We used another one to find out all sorts of information about your network interfaces. Does anyone remember what that was?
I can't remember what it was, but I wanted to use it with my girlfriend the other day and it wouldn't come to me.
IPconfig, or ipconfig /all, which will give you every network interface that you've got on your machine. So that way you can find out what your...
/all?
Yes. So if you type IP, go into your command line and do it now, folks, and see what happens. Open a command prompt and then type the word ipconfig /all and press enter. How are we doing?
I see which adapters are connected.
Okay, now you can ping your own IP address. It will tell you what it is there to check that your NIC is working properly. And then you can ping your default gateway to see whether you can get out of the network. If you can do that, of course, you've got a nice connection, which you will have because you're all connected successfully here. So if you can't ping any of those successfully, you need to troubleshoot. Anyone having difficulties?
Nope.
John, Kate, how are you doing?
Nope. When he stops talking, no problems.
Got it.
Excellent. Okay, so that's a good way to test connectivity. You ping your own address, ping your default or another, and then another computer on your network if you've got one, and then your default gateway, and then you try to ping outside that onto another website like Lonsdale Media or Cisco or Google. Actually, Google's a good one because it's always got ping on. So that's a good way to test your connection. Right, there are also some notes in the section on Telnet. There is an optional part of the 8.9.2 worksheet on Telnet that you can do. It's optional because we don't have Telnet servers for you to play with, so you don't have to do that. But what you do have to know about it is it's a transfer system, file system, but it's not secure. All the transfers are done in clear text, so they're easily readable. And check out diagrams 2, 3, and 4 in section 8.9.2, and you will find all the information that you could need on Telnet. Does anyone remember what the port number for Telnet is?
Is that
23?
Yes, it is, Kim. You're right, 23. Okay. Before we move on to quickly installing a modem, any questions about how to install and test connectivity? Okay, a modem. Good old dial-up networking. When was the last time I did that? Goodness, I can't remember. Anyway, a modem is an electronic device that transfers data between one computer and another using analog signals over a telephone line. The modem converts digital data to analog signals for transmission. The modem at the receiving end reconverts the analog signal back to digital data to be interpreted by the computer. And the process of doing all this is called modulation and demodulation. Modem-based transmission is very accurate. Okay, Terry.
And very slow.
Terry says last time she used the modem was, February 22nd. That wasn't that long ago. I haven't used it for years and years and years. I don't even know that I could remember. Okay, but it's very accurate communication. Now, you might still occasionally have to configure a serial ports for old modems, but I can't quite imagine in which scenario you would have to do that, as well as install drivers much in the same way as for NICs. Now, read the details on the Hayes-compatible command set in the notes and in the accompanying diagram, and that's what I'm going to say about modems at this point, because really we don't have too much to do with them these days. Okay, other connection technologies. Who can think of some connection technologies that we use? We've talked about some of them already in brief. There's dial-up networking, and there's what else?
Cable and ADSL.
Yep, and satellite and ISDN. And I'll introduce you to those now. All right, telephone technologies. The analog telephone, of course, which is, again, we've just talked about dial-up, uses the POTS, the plain old telephone service, to connect via modems to the network. Now, it's inexpensive, but you can't use the net and voice at the same time, and you're limited to a maximum bandwidth of 56 kbps if you're lucky. So we all know about dial-up. I'm sure we've all used it at some point or other. Okay, Integrated Service Digital Network, ISDN, and you'll find a lot of broadcasters actually use this to connect remote interviews. For instance, when we conduct
outside broadcasts.
No, to connect remote studios. For instance, when Elise and I participated in an interview along with Jackie via phone about Cavi for the 1 in 5 program, Elise and I were connected. She sat in the Melbourne studios of the ABC and I was at Radio NZ in Wellington, and we used ISDN to connect the two. So it's often used for those sorts in those kind of environments still, even though it's a fairly slow and cumbersome way of doing it. It still seems to be fairly effective for that kind of application. Now, ISDN uses analog telephone signals. It uses the analog telephone wires to carry voice and digital technology, and you can even use video on ISDN. So you've got two technologies running side by side here, rather than with DSL, which is using the same physical wire and at different frequencies. You've got two separate technologies running here. And that's the difference between ISDN and DSL. There are three types of ISDN: basic rate interface, primary rate interface, and broadband ISDN, and they all have their different rates. And those are all listed in diagram one in this section. So be aware of the specs for all those. And of course, there's a worksheet for questions to be answered on those things. Now, basically, ISDN uses separate channels, usually called B for voice and data, as well as a D channel for signal control and for extra data when necessary. So the channels, the voice and data channels, are usually called channel B, and the tear down and control channel is usually called D. And the rate at which the data is transferred depends on whether it's basic rate, primary rate, or broadband ISDN. Okay, is that all clear? Cool. DSL, good old DSL, which is what most of us, not all of us, some of us are using cable. Now, DSL uses existing copper wires and digital technology. The voice and internet can be simultaneous. So unlike IDSN, which has separate channels, digital is shared with analog on the same wires by limiting the bandwidth of the analog signal. That's why telephones sound so much more less clear than, say, Skype does, because the telephone bandwidth is being limited very severely so that the digital, so there's room for the digital signals as well. Now, diagram two in the section explains all the different iterations of DSL. You don't have to learn them, but be aware that they're all there. Now,
so because of that sharing of digital and analog on the one wire is why you then have to have interference things put on your phones between, like, in your house.
Yes, you use filters to separate the two signals. You're right, Kate. That's exactly why. So that's DSL. And, of course, the speeds vary between DSL, DSL2, and VDSL, and all the rest of them. Now, most of us use ADSL, which is asymmetric DSL, which means that the download speed is much faster than the upload speed. And, of course, download refers to coming from the network to our computers, and upload refers to data going from our computers into the ether. So, and usually with ADSL, it's very asymmetric. It's much faster down than it is up. So that's really, at the moment, all you need to know about ADSL. Now, who received and read the article on power line communication that I sent to the discussion list?
Yes, all the discussion that came afterwards.
Now, it's becoming more popular, and it's getting faster. In fact, it's quite a lot faster than it states here now in this section. But basically, it uses power distribution wires on your local or national grid to send and receive data. You'll also hear it called power line networking, PLN, mains communication, or power line telecom, PLT. Now, with PLC, power line communication, an electric company can superimpose an analog signal over the standard 50 or 60 Hz AC that travels in the power lines. AC being alternating current, of course. The analog signal can carry voice and data signals. Now, It's good to use in areas where other high-speed connections are not available, and it's also good if you want to avoid having cable all over your house. I'm considering trying it here, for instance, especially now that Netgear is coming out with kits which have also got filters in them to try to counteract the noise on older electrical wires. So what you do is you have an adapter kit, and one end plugs into the router and your electrical socket nearby, and the other end plugs into any electrical socket in the house that you like. Now, of course, as it said in the article, that will vary. The strength of the communication will vary, and the link lights on the adapter will tell you about what sort of signal strength that you've got. But it's a good way of extending your network reasonably cheaply, and its speed is increasing all the time. So actually, it could be quite handy. Any questions?
I was actually thinking about it for here because we've got a steel frame house, and my daughter seems to have a lot of connection problems in her bedroom with the wireless, and I thought it might have been a way of fixing things up here for her a bit, but apparently the system's not available in Australia because of the voltage of our power.
It should be available because it's certainly available here, and it has been for some time. So if you go to your local computer guy, Dave was his name, and ask about it, I'm sure he'll be able to tell you. Netgear has been making the kits for quite a while. I know they've been available on the New Zealand website, so I'm sure that the adapters are available here and in Australia. I'm tempted to try it too, although we have older wiring in this house. The big disadvantage of PLC, of course, is signal degradation, and that's evidenced by the diagram in the section on PLC, which is 8.10.2. So that's the big disadvantage that it has, apart from the fact that you can have interference from... And by the way, don't plug it into a surge suppressor. That's the other thing that it said in the article. Plug it directly into a wall socket and make sure it's not a wall socket that's near microwaves and things like that. So you have to pick your wall socket that you plug it into, but it's getting faster and better all the time. So yeah, I'm tempted to try it too, Kate. Right, 8.10.3, broadband. Now, we've talked about broadband very briefly in last week's lecture. Basically, broadband is about transmitting multiple signals using multiple frequencies over one media, for example, cable TV. Because the two transmission types use different frequencies, they do not interfere with each other, mostly. Sometimes they do. These frequencies can be further divided into channels. And right, some common broadband network connections include cable, DSL, ISDN, and satellite. Now, good old Bluetooth is a broadband wireless connection. And what do we know about Bluetooth, people?
Short distance.
Yes. What else? Yes, Terry, short wave range radio frequency. I'll have to interpret the chat because it doesn't actually come out through the recording. You can connect multiple devices using that frequency, and it creates a wireless personal area network, or WPAN. And the standard for Bluetooth is 802.15.1. You can use Bluetooth for voice and data, and figure 2 in that section has all the common characteristics. Now, there are three classifications for Bluetooth. Class 1 has a range of approximately 100 metres, or 330 feet. Class 2, which is the most common one, I believe, for the moment, has a range of approximately 10 metres or 33 feet. And Class 3 has a range of approximately 1 metre or 3 feet. Now, the thing about Bluetooth is they operate in the 2.4 to 2.485 gigahertz radio frequency range. Now, that's in the industrial, scientific and medical band, which the ISM band, which is extremely crowded. So, it incorporates something called adaptive frequency hopping, AFH, which allows signals to hop around using the different frequencies within the Bluetooth range to try to reduce the chance of interference when you've got multiple devices connected. So Bluetooth is short range, it uses AFH, and it exists in the 2.4 to 2.485 gigahertz frequency. Right. Good old cellular WAN technology, who, besides Elise and I, have got a USB stick that you can use to connect to the internet when you're away from home.
Me.
Oh, Kate, yes. What you're doing is connecting using the cellular or 3G network. And so has Terry.
And Terry.
They're very cool. You can do lots of things with those things. Figure 3, in Figure 3, there's a comparison of all the different cellular WAN characteristics. Now, it's slower than a DSL and cable connection, but it's still fast enough to be classified as a high-speed broadband connection. And it can use one or more of the following technologies. Global System for Mobile Communications, or GSM, and that's a standard used by the worldwide cellular network in some parts of the world and not in others. General Packet Radio Service, or GPRS, you've actually seen that, I'm sure, bandied around the place, and that's a data service for users of GSM. That may or may not be a test alert, but I have seen it bandied around somewhere. GPRS, General Packet Radio Service. Quad band refers to the fact that a cellular phone can operate on all four GSM frequencies, 850 MHz, 900 MHz, 180 MHz, and 1800 MHz, and 1900 MHz. So that's what quad band is. And of course, you all know what SMS is, don't you? And MMS, so I don't need to tell you what they are. Now, there's enhanced data rates for GSM evolution, which is called EDGE. And there's also something which you will be using more and more often called High-Speed Downlink Packet Access, HSDPA. And that provides enhanced G3 access speed. And again, there's a diagram for characteristics on all of this. Okay, have I confused everybody thoroughly before we move on to cable? No? Oh, cool. Okay, good old cable. Of course, as you know, a cable modem, and Terry has cable on her connection, connects your computer to the cable company using the same coaxial cable that connects to your cable television, if you have cable TV. Remember that coax is that nice big thick round stuff that's very strong. It's built around a shielded core. It actually has better shielding than Ethernet. And you can plug your computer directly into the cable modem, or you can connect a router, switch, hub, or multipurpose network device so that you can have a little home network of your own. And it's very similar with DSL. We've already talked about the fact that the different frequencies are carried on the one copper telephone wire and that a filter is used to prevent the signals from interfering with phone signals. You plug the filter into a phone jack and plug the phone into the filter. But the modem doesn't need a filter. You can also get things like splitters as well to help split the signals off. Okay, ISDN is another example of broadband, and of course it uses multiple channels and can carry different types of services. Therefore, it is a type of broadband. And I explained what you can use ISDN for earlier, so I'm not going to repeat myself. Okay, satellite. Now, satellite is actually used a lot in the rural areas here in New Zealand. A lot of farmers are now deploying satellite because they find that dial-up just doesn't meet their needs, because farming is big business in this country, as it is in Australia, I know. It's a very important business. So a lot of people use satellite because they can't get anything else in their area. So it's a good alternative for people in rural areas and in places where other connections aren't available. Now, it doesn't require a phone line or cable, but uses a satellite dish for two-way communications. The download speeds are typically up to 500 kbps, so it's not that fast, and uploads are closer to 56 kbps. So it's still pretty slow, and one of the big disadvantages is that they can fill up with snow in the wintertime, which tends to happen in the South Island with farmers who use satellite. The dishes fill up with snow and become unusable, which is not very helpful. Okay, and the reason it's so slow is that it takes time from the satellite dish for the satellite dish to relay all the data through to ISP and via the satellites orbiting the Earth. So just be aware of that satellite is an option for people if there's no other connection available in the area. But
And then the Americans reposition the satellites and muck it all up for us after anyway.
Yeah, as well. So there's lots of big disadvantages to satellite, unfortunately. We do have a couple of satellite companies here, not many. It hasn't really taken off in this country, but as I said, there are some farmers who use it because they don't have any other option. But the one that we're all hankering after is good old fibre, because it provides faster connection speeds and bandwidth than anything else. And because it's made of glass or plastic, it is immune from interference and noise. Of course, it's best for really advanced things like video streaming and conferencing. A single fibre pair can carry millions of phone calls as compared to a single copper pair, which can carry 6 calls max. So that's pretty amazing, but it's really it's bloody expensive, actually. So that's really one of the disadvantages of having fibre. It's still really, really expensive. Now, another technology that we all use, of course, is good old VoIP. And when we talk on Skype, we use VoIP. And it's a method of doing telephone and voice over the network, because it's voice over internet. VoIP converts the analog signals of our voices into digital information that is transported in IP packets. So it's pretty damn clever, actually, because it's actually hard to do, because human voices are so individual. But you can also use VoIP over an existing IP network to provide access to the public switched telephone network, or PSTN. And I know that both Elise and Terry use that in their own homes. So instead of using a telephone over your phone lines, you can have a telephone adapter plugged into your router, and there are some extremely good packages that you can get through those services, much, much cheaper and much more flexible than what are offered by your traditional telecom services.
I've got one as well.
Oh, you do, Kate. Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I'm thinking of getting it.
Good. You just ring up the Canada and United States, like the people next door.
The big disadvantage with it, of course, is that you need an internet connection. So if your internet goes down, goodbye telephone service. So a backup landline is always a good thing, or a good cell phone. So it's a good idea to have a backup.
You can't call 000 on them either.
No, you can't.
That's right, and 000 is the equivalent of 911 if you happen to be in America or Canada. It's not a Class 1 service, so yeah, as Kylie says, it's best to have a PSTN standard phone line around.
Or a decent cell phone, yeah. I don't know if I was by myself whether I'd have a PSTN. I would in this house, because my sister would insist on keeping our PSTN, which would be a good thing. But yeah, okay, virtual private networks, now they're cool. A virtual private network, or a VPN, is a way for someone to remotely connect to a company network using using the internet. The connection is secure and functions just as if the user was physically connected to that network. So, if I was sitting at home and say I worked for a company in Wellington, I could securely authenticate, which means I'd provide the correct username and password into their network using a secure connection called a tunnel. And once I'd authenticated, all of the traffic between me and the network would be encrypted, so that I could use the network just as if I was physically sitting in an office connected to it, which is really good for telecommuters, as they're coming to be called, or people who have to travel a lot. And there's a really good diagram in this section to show you how it all works. And that is the last diagram in section 8.1 before we move on to preventive maintenance. Is there any questions? Cool. Well, the preventive maintenance section in this chapter is actually quite short, because there's really only one big issue that you need to watch out for in terms of problems that could cause a whole network to go down. It's mentioned, and that's heat. But we'll talk about a couple of principles first. Now, if only one computer fails, this of course will affect that user. But if a network fails, this can affect a lot of people. So you need to check equipment for overheating, especially in the server room, because if you've got a lot of electronic equipment together, it gets pretty hot in there, so you need all kinds of fans and expellier equipment to make sure that there is dust is kept out of the place and that it doesn't get too overheated. You also need to check network cables for faults. Maybe they're loose, maybe there's a bit of tape on them, and there's a bit of a story that Elise has about that, about Jackie's computer that ended up being a bad cable after a whole heap of other things were checked, AE. Basically what happened was Jackie's internet connection was playing up and getting slow, and they found, because she'd got a new router, she hadn't actually changed the cable, and the old cable had a bit of sellotape on it. Once she changed it to the new cable, the problem was all solved. So checking network cables is also a really good idea, and labelling them is also recommended, because that saves troubleshooting time, especially in an organisation where you've got a server and lots of switches and hubs and routers and things. You need to label the cables so you know what goes where. Also, it's a good idea to follow any wiring diagrams and not to use fake equipment or software, because that can degrade your performance and mean you've got no comeback if everything falls over, as it invariably will if you use a knockoff. So it's recommended that you always purchase from manufacturers or from their authorised partners. Okay, is that all very clear before we go on to troubleshooting? We've got lots of time for troubleshooting, so this could be cool. Okay, a good rule of thumb. When troubleshooting network issues, first determine whether the problem is with one computer or with the network. If the computer, fix that, of course. You know, you don't need to do anything else. But if the problem is in the network, start in the server room and eliminate one issue at a time. That, by the way, is called the bottom-up troubleshooting method, but you don't cover that in this course. It's much more in the CCNA level networking courses, but because you're dealing with the physical equipment, it's bottom-up. Also, you need to check out the list of anti-counterfeiting tips in the diagram in section 8.12, and I have covered counterfeiting all I need to. I think it's pretty obvious, really, that you purchase from the recommended partners and that you don't take someone's too good to be true offer, because it usually is. All right, the troubleshooting process. Network problems can result from a combination of hardware, software, and connectivity issues. So here we're getting more complex because we've got a network, we've got a whole heap of more issues to deal with than we would if we were dealing with a single machine. Right, what kind of questions can you ask the customer if they're having network issues? We're doing identify the problem, which is our first step, so what sort of questions could we ask?
We could find out when they last successfully connected, and whether they've done anything different to their computer since then.
Yes. What else?
We could check whether there's been any, ask whether there's been any power failures or equipment turned on and off since last time they used it.
Yeah. Kim, what else? What else could we ask a customer when we're trying to identify a network problem? Are you there, Kim? You're showing up, but still here.
Oops. She went off to get an apple.
Okay.
You could ask them what, if they can see the lights on their network, that you could ask them what indicators are showing up, which might tell you what's gone wrong.
Yeah. What about how they're connected? Would that be a good question to ask, do you think?
I would have thought that if you were working with them in their environment, you would have known that. But yes, you could ask them that.
No, you don't always know. If you're sitting in your IT department and someone calls you, say, from personnel to say, oh, I can't get into my internet, they could be using wireless in their area or they could be using cable. So you need to know how they're connected, because that will change the way you deal with their problem. What about checking whether they can see their network devices? For instance, in an office, they might have a shared printer or shared network storage. Can they log on to their network? That kind of thing.
I suppose you could also ask them if anyone who shares that network nearby them is able to access, and whether it's just them or whether it's the whole area.
Exactly. Yeah, good one, Kate. Right. Okay, number two. Number two, theory of probable causes. Okay, what could cause some of these connection issues, do we think?
Somebody's walked past and kicked out the cable.
Yeah, that happens actually quite a lot. What else could do it? You're my only student at the moment, Kate. Sorry, Terry.
Sometimes if there's been a power failure, network doesn't start itself back up automatically.
So how are you going to start it back up if that happens?
Well, you usually have to, what I have to do is I have to actually unplug it all, let it set for 10 or 15 seconds to reset itself, then just plug it all back in and turn it all back on again.
Yep, okay. What about checking the NIC or the IP addressing information?
Well, that would probably help.
Okay. Another one that listed here is low wireless signal strength. It could be that the wireless access point is too far away. And again, it says invalid IP address. Now, determine an exact cause. You could check all the cables are connected to the proper locations, as we've just discussed. Unseat and then reconnect cables and connectors. Reboot the computer or the network device. Okay, what else could you possibly do?
You could try and see whether other people are able to connect.
Yeah, how could you do that? There are several ways you could do that. Yeah, Terry, we could replace cables, but we're talking about user information now. So how could you check that someone else can connect and you can't? There are several ways. You can check with another person, or you can log in as a different user. That sometimes will tell you. So the administrator might try, if you've called them down to your desk, they might try logging in as themselves, or they might try logging in as a guest user or with some different credentials to see if that helps. So there are all these things that you could do. Now, of course, implementing the solution, we all know how to research those. What are some sources that we can use for researching the solution?
Well, we can go to other technicians in our department. We can go to the internet, and we can also go to the manufacturers' websites and manuals.
Yep, exactly, Kate. There's heaps of stuff, and in the one worksheet in Chapter 10 asks you to do all that. It asks you to pick a component and to find all of the research resources that are pertinent to that component. So that's kind of cool. Now, verifying full system functionality. What could you do in the command line, for instance, to verify that the system is working properly?
You could ping the address.
Yeah, and what's the command again for displaying all of your network information?
ipconfig /all.
Yep, exactly. That's also a good thing to use to check out that things are happening properly. Okay, there's another one called NSLookup, and that's used to query internet domain name servers. It returns a list of hosts in a domain or the information from one host. And of course, there's good old, what's the other one we used last week?
TRACERT.
Traceroute or traceroute, yeah. And that does what?
It tells you that the route and information has to take from you to wherever you're tracing. So, for instance, if I traced out to Elise's website, it would tell me all of the routers and things that had to go through to get to there.
All of the hops.
Yeah, each one's called a hop. And of course, it says here you can use something called NetView to display a list of computers in a work group, and it shows available shared resources on a network. So there are lots of things that you could do. Okay, and number six is, what's the last step in our troubleshooting process?
We show the customer the solution to the problem and get them to redo what they were doing before, document our findings and send them the bill.
Good one, Kate. Okay. Section 8.1.2.2, some common network problems and solutions. Are you back, Kim?
She's back.
Cool. Okay. Well, it seems we might have lost John. Terry, feel free to participate in the chat at any time, and we will be happy to interpret what you say.
I can now watch for Terry's message, because I've finished doing all the things I'll tell you about after class.
Cool. Okay. First problem, the NIC LED lights are not lit. What could be happening, people? What's the most likely causes of that problem?
Try turning on the power.
Yeah, Kim?
Well, if they're not working, then maybe you don't have a... you're not able to connect to the net, or... God, sorry, I'm not expressing things very clearly today.
Is the card seated, or has it come loose?
And maybe your cable
has come loose. Has it come loose?
That's a good one, actually, yeah.
And maybe the cable isn't pushed in properly. There could be a faulty cable even.
Yeah, exactly. It could be any one of those things. So, what
we
want to do...
Oh, one thing we missed. We missed the faulty port.
Yeah, sometimes that can happen too, although I don't know if it's as common, unless you've been reefing the network cable in and out incorrectly. That could do it. So what are we going to do to fix it?
Turn on the...
Try to replace a cable.
And try rebooting the device.
Yep, that sometimes can work. Yep.
But if we replaced Kim's cable, reseated the device from Terry, and turned on the power and reset the device, it better work then.
Yeah, it better, hadn't it?
Oh, you're what?
I'll get out my dad's solution. It's called a hammer.
There you go.
Yeah, that works for me.
You'll fix it then, for good.
Okay, here's another problem. The user cannot telnet into a remote device. Now, you could use telnet, you could use SSH, any service. But this user wants to use a particular service like that, and they can't. So what might be the problem here? It has to do with software now, folks, usually.
They probably don't have the right software or the right drivers.
Possibly. What else could...
Maybe they use the wrong port.
Yeah, you're getting there. You're getting close there, Kim. It's all about ports. There's something in your computer which might be blocking it. What is it?
Maybe your firewall.
Hey, great minds think alike. Yep, the firewall could be blocking port. And because we're talking about Telnet, we're talking about port what?
23.
Exactly. Okay. Now, there could be another reason why someone can't telnet, which has to do with something administrator can fix and what that might be. What's a good thing about a network that you can be flexible about its use in terms of its individual users?
Changing permissions.
Yeah, exactly. Then the permissions might not be set for that user to use telnet. Okay, so all those things can apply. Now, to get them up and running for telnet, what might you do?
You can unblock the... We're talking about the admin, or are we talking about just... I was going to say, you can unblock the port with the firewall.
Yeah, you can. Okay, yep, that's the first thing.
You can change the permissions for that user to enable them to use it.
Yes, and the first thing you talked about, the right configuration, you...
Ensure you've got the correct drivers and configurations.
Exactly. So now can you see that our problems, because we're dealing with network issues, are a hell of a lot more complex than they are with a separate computer. There's all kinds of things that you have to consider. Okay, next problem. An older laptop cannot detect the wireless router.
It may not even be wireless capable.
That's true. My sister's wasn't. She didn't have a wireless. She's got a really old Dell, and there's no wireless access card in it. We had to go and buy a USB one for hers. What else?
Well, that'd be the first thing I'd check, because that's most likely. And then probably it might not have, even if it has wireless, it might be an older style and like an older protocols, and the protocols don't match.
Very good, Kate.
Getting
yeah.
close, yeah. What is it?
That's
that we
very
talking
good.
About? We discussed A, B, G, and N, yep, in this class.
Yeah, and that has happened. I actually, Elise and I both have a friend up in Queensland who had that problem with his voice sense. When he updated his router, he couldn't connect his voice sense any longer.
Mm.
So I had to tell him how to fix the problem. Now, there's something else that you need for a wireless connection, and it's not being broadcast. What is it? Does anyone know? We don't actually talk about this until next chapter, but if you connected wireless NIC, I know you did this, Terry, this morning, it's called the SSID, Service Set Identifier. So if that's not broadcast, you might also not see the connection.
But yeah, you still can I'm connect lazy. To it if you know the name of your network. So there you go. You know your SSID, you can still connect to it if you know it's there, but... When it's not broadcasting, you don't know it's there, unless you're a hacker. But it's often used as a security measure to stop broadcasting. It's sort of a sort of way that people often sort of hide their networks so that some of the less experienced hackers and crackers and stuff aren't likely to break into you.
And we'll talk more about that in the security chapter.
I leave my SSID right. visible, but I've got 128-bit encryption, so that's all right.
Yeah. Well, I have clients coming here, so I like to leave mine visible too, just because it's also easy to connect, etc.
I leave mine visible because my sister would never want to type in each time when she connects. She just would never want to do that.
It would probably remember it. It would remember it for the next across different window sessions, but anyway, just in case you needed to, yeah, it's better to leave it on sometimes for some users.
She'd go through
it. Just made mine connect to it every time. And automatically.
Ah, okay. Now, you can configure your router to make sure that it accepts all of your wireless protocols, and usually it's done by something called a mixed mode. You can configure it for a single mode, usually B, G, or N, but you can also configure it for mixed mode so that it'll take any of those protocols. It'll slow down the performance, but and that's what I told our friend to do when he was complaining that he couldn't connect his voice sense to his new router, because he had it connected to G only, and I think his card in the voice sense was a B, so I told him to put it on mixed mode. He wasn't happy with the fact that the performance would be sacrificed a little bit, but hey, if you want to connect, then sometimes you have to do that. Now, you can also configure your wireless to your router to broadcast the SSID, which we've just talked about. And, of course, you also need to check where to make sure that the wireless connection is enabled in the wireless NIC. Where would you check for that?
In the device manager.
Exactly, the device manager. Okay. The next problem. The computer has an IP address of 169.254.x.x. What does that mean? We talked about this last week.
Is it an IP address that's letting you know that the computer isn't connected?
Yes, and do you remember what that is called, the acronym for what's happening here?
No, I forgot.
APIPA, a PIPA. So what does it mean? What's happening when we have an address like that? What's the most likely cause, do you think?
I should remember this.
Remember we talked about it in the DHCP section?
Club, I don't.
We talked about it in the DHCP section. Remember, when we get in a PIPA address when the computer is trying to automatically assign IP addresses and it can't do it because it can't connect. So, what could be the cause of that? And I said something, I made it very clear that Cisco had an answer that it was applying because it's actually a test question. So,
DHCP.
No, it's a physical answer, this one. It's a hardware answer.
Yeah. DHCP server available caused by the answer to the Cisco question is the logical path to that answer. No DHCP server available. So Kim's answer is actually correct, but it is that Cisco are being English teachers here, and it is caused by a broken physical connection, which is a layer one, which is a, come on everybody, come on, let's get there, a broken what?
What's layer one? What's layer one?
A broken cable.
Go,
and
Terry,
yes.
And go,
and
Kate. Well
Kate.
Done, the both
yes.
of you. Broken cable. Broken so when you cable. See it in the exam, answer the cable.
That's the answer that Cisco wants. Of course, it was happening on a wireless, which happened to me a while back. It can't be a broken cable. So what might it be then?
Interference on the wireless or a broken wireless device?
No, it's got to do with if you can't get DHCP, then what might be wrong with that dialogue box that you fiddle around in?
You've put the wrong address in?
Yeah, exactly. I had sort of incorrect partial addressing information in there. So I hit the repair button on the network card properties and it fixed itself all up. We won't cover what it actually does until the advanced networking chapter in chapter 15. But yeah, that's basically what happened. So to fix the other thing, of course, you would replace the cable or you would check the router to see whether it is functioning. Now, it does actually mention here release and renew. So you would release and renew the IP address on the computer. You can do that by pressing the repair button in the properties of the network card, or you can use the commands release and renew in the command line. Now, let's talk a little bit about what release and renew are. Remember, what do we remember about what DHCP does, folks?
Does that set the IP address?
Not only the IP address, but all kinds of other information.
A couple of other bits and pieces.
Like the DNS and the subnet mask and the whatever else that I can't remember.
Default gateway. You just about had them all there, Kate. Yep, it does. Okay, now, do we remember how it does that? It leases what? It leases
the IP address for a period of time.
And after which it...
And then it expires and it has to find a new one.
It puts it back into the pool that's available for any other. So what you're doing when you're releasing and renewing is actually telling the DHCP, okay, we want to release this address from this device now and go and let you... It's like pressing the reset button. On the Braille note, I suppose, we're releasing this information that you currently have for this device. We want you to get a new set of information and start all over again. So that's what release renew is doing.
Okay, so when I looked at my thing earlier today, I had 192.168.0.181. So I can tell it to release 181, and it might come back with a different address, or it might reassign me 181 again.
Exactly. Okay, we are doing so well here, and we have lots. Okay, problem.
Sorry, one more question about that
release
renew.
Yep.
With that release renew thing, do you just I'm assuming it's from the command line, so you type release space slash renew, or
no, you have to release the address first and then you have to renew. There are two separate commands. I actually find it easier just to go into the properties of the network card and press the repair button, and you hear Windows is actually disabling the device and doing a release renew. JAWS will tell you actually that's what it's doing. It's really quite cool.
Oh, okay, I get it, yep.
But we'll cover that a bit more in detail in Chapter 15, but that's basically what it does. Okay, yet another problem. A remote device, that means a device that is not connected locally, does not respond to a ping request. Now, a remote device can be what? Remote means it's not local. Local means internal. Remote means?
Like another server somewhere else?
Yes, or another website or something like that. So, if you can't ping it, what might that mean?
Well, either they've got a problem or you've got a problem.
Yes, okay. What else could it mean?
It might mean that your information isn't leaving your local area to go to the remote area, so there might be something wrong with your connection between your computer. For instance, the plug might be out of the wall, or the cable might be out of the wall, or something like that.
I think this question is assuming that you can ping your local devices but you can't ping remote ones. It's not very clear, but I think from the answers it's giving here that it's assuming that you can ping locally but you can't ping a remote device. Now we tried pinging Cisco, for instance, and we got timeout. What was the reason for that, remember?
Oh, they had their ping turned off. You can turn off pinging or something.
You can, and you do that through firewall. Even Windows firewall, as I said, enables ping by default, but you can turn it off. So it could be that the firewall, their firewall, is blocking ping, or that yours is.
You can fix yours, but you can't fix theirs.
Exactly. That's why I said Google is a good, if you want to ping a remote device, Google is a good one to ping, because they do allow ping. I don't know why. They're a huge corporation and they must get heaps of pings a day from lots of people, but they do allow ping, fortunately, so they're a good way one to ping when you're testing remote connectivity. So this troubleshooting is all about your firewall settings, or the firewall settings, possible firewall settings of the remote device. Now, if you know that your ping is allowed, you could do what to further test?
Could you try a tracer? Traceroo?
Yeah, you could. That would be a good one to try to see, you know, how far it's getting. Yeah, that would be a good one. Okay, the next one. Next problem. One user can log on to the local network but cannot access the internet. So the other one was a remote problem. This is a local problem. They can log on to the local network. They can see all the devices in their local network, like their shared printer, but they can't get outside into the internet. What's the problem?
Maybe the cable between the local network and the outside is broken?
No, because if there was a broken cable, they wouldn't even be able to log on at all. They wouldn't be able to do anything like that. So they can log on and see their... Remember, the internet, their network has two parts. Your internal part. Say you logged on, Kate, and you could see your daughter's computer, but you couldn't connect to the internet. What might be wrong? And what's the divider between the inside and the outside of your network? Anyone else want to try and answer that as well?
One thing that sometimes happens here is mine's a wireless network connected through a router to the outside world, and sometimes you can see the things on the internal network, but there's a fault between the from the router to the outside world.
Yes, exactly. And that is called the what? What's that called? It's in that dialog box of all the things you need to configure.
The default gateway.
Fantastic. Yeah. So that means that you can't get outside, which means your default gateway address is incorrect. So, what would you do to fix it?
Can you fix that the same way with the with the release and renew?
That would be overkill. There's a much easier way to do it, which is go where? Where does that dialogue box exist with all the stuff in it? Someone other than Kate, Terry, Kim? And the network settings are... Yeah, network settings is right, Terry. And where are they found? Yeah, under the something properties of your something.
The network properties of your modem, of your router.
No. Kim, where do you find your network settings, Kim?
Oh, I find them in Network and Sharing Center on my desktop. Or search for it. Or go into Control Panel.
Yeah, but I'm talking about actually not in Windows 7 specifically, but universally. They're under a certain properties of a certain piece of hardware.
Ah, my network card. I don't know. Sorry, I'm having trouble thinking it's kind of late.
Okay, yeah, the network card, and the properties are the TCPIP. For you, it's V4 properties. So that's where you find that dialog box with your IP address, your default gateway, subnet mask, and DNS under the TCPIP properties of your network card. And of course, each network card will have slightly different ones because each network card will have a different address.
Yeah, you're right about each network card having different addresses, but I think what you're implying is that you can get at it via the device manager. I don't think you can.
No, I'm not. I haven't said that at all.
No, but that's the implication I was feeling. That's all. That could mislead less experienced folk. That's all. You're right. It's a different IP address for each interface.
So you'd go under Control Panel and find the TCPIP properties of your network card under there, or of course put TCPIP into your search box, which is what I'd do if I was you guys on Windows 7. Save all this mucking about.
Network
okay.
sharing, I think it is anyway. So.
Yeah, yes, it is. Yeah. So you know network, where to find them.
Still called isn't it called Network under XP still? Been a little while since I looked there.
Yeah, it's called Network under XP and it's under network and sharing, but it's also called TCPIP V4 for you lot, and just TCPIP for XP.
I remember that from the worksheets.
TCPIP Internet Protocol, it said in my Windows XP box.
Yes, and for you guys, it's V4, so because you've also got V6, as you discovered last week when you were looking at your configuration settings. Okay.
And if you cursor up and down the list view, you'll also see your network card in the same box as well. And that's also where, in the old days, that same dialog box is where we'd have NetBUI, which is no longer used, and IPSX PX would also be available to users in that same dialog box, which, of course, is no longer really used. We're only really doing TCPIP stuff here. So there you go.
Yeah, so on XP, it's under Network Connections and Control Panel, and for you lot, it's under your Network and Sharing. You'd go in there and you'd find your LAN settings and your TCPIP properties, and there you would find all that information. You just put the right default gateway address in, and you should connect. Okay, we have got time. Yes, we definitely have time for another problem. Now, this one, the network is fully functional and the wireless laptop connection is enabled, but the laptop cannot connect to the network. So the network is working and everything appears to be okay, but the laptop can't connect to the wireless network.
Maybe it's too far away.
Yeah, perhaps it's out of range. It's a good one, and that's the one that Cisco tends to like, actually. And that's an exam question, so... watch for that. It's not exactly the same as what this troubleshooting problem is, but that's the answer. Is it's look for the range. So you've got that. You're on the right track there. What else could it be?
Someone disabling the wireless card.
Yep, that blasted little Johnny has been fiddling again, hasn't he? It's time to take him out the back and shoot him, which is what my esteemed supervisor suggested in her worksheet, which is very good. Yeah, I thought.
When I was a student 3 years ago. Yep. We had that up the other... Were you on the channel then when we had that up the other day, Kylie?
Yes, it was very funny.
Yeah.
I do that all the time.
Disable your wireless card.
Well,
shoot little Johnny.
I'm not even going to answer any of that.
All right, okay. Now, what else could be doing? What else could be causing the lack of connection when everything looks good?
Very good answer by Terry.
I'm always turning my Wi-Fi switch off.
Yeah. The Wi-Fi switch can be turned off on the new laptops that Kim and I bought. It actually has a physical hardware switch. And on my EEE PC, and I think most of the EEE PCs, it's done with holding a FN key down and toggling that and Bluetooth off. And I'm led to believe it's part of the 802.11 standards is that the Wi-Fi actually has to be disabled either by software or physical means, I guess, to enable security or / troubleshooting / whatever.
Well, my Wi-Fi switch is on a soft panel along the top of the computer, and it's right on the right hand end next to the right hand speaker. So if I go and accidentally, sometimes hit numpad or something like that and I miss it, there goes the wireless. And Terry's right, you have to disable it when you're on a plane or that sort of thing as well.
Yep, indeed.
There's one more thing they mention here in the notes is that could be wrong. Now, some routers, a lot of routers don't have a physical one anymore, one you can't feel, but mine does, to show it's a wireless router. What's that?
An aerial?
Yeah, the antenna, and yep. that could be misaligned. So there's all those things that could be wrong. And of course, to repair to enable your wireless connection, what would you do?
Repair your antenna, make sure your wireless switch is turned on, and then perhaps reset everything and get it to automatically start up again.
Yes, and of course, again, because it's a network card, you go to the properties under control panel, under the TCP/IP properties, under the wireless properties under control panel, and make sure all your settings are correct. Okay, we've still got about 8 minutes to go, but we have come to the end. We've just got the summary now. So basically, we've talked about the fundamentals of networking and the benefits of having a network, the ways to connect computers to a network, the different aspects of troubleshooting a network, and we gave examples of how to analyze and implement simple solutions, and we've just done all that. And the following concepts from this chapter are important to remember. A computer network is composed of two or more computers that share data and resources. A LAN refers to what people?
Local area network.
And what are the characteristics of the local area network?
It's internal and it shares information just locally within itself.
Not necessarily. A LAN doesn't need to be something that is there's one key characteristic, which is about the administration.
A single administrator.
Yeah, under the same administrative control. Okay, so that's what a LAN is. Now a WAN is what people?
A wide area network. Has several administrators.
And it connects what?
Lots and lots of different local area networks.
Fantastic. Okay. In a peer-to-peer network, what are the characteristics of a peer-to-peer network?
I know it's something about people sharing just from one to the other, but I've forgotten exactly.
Okay. It's good for very small networks and no one has, for instance, your home network unless you're running a server, Kate.
I know. I've figured it out.
What? Yep.
Everybody has their own controls. It's not controlled by one administrator.
And a client server network is?
Good.
Come on, Terry. What's a client server network?
It is good.
Apart from that, yeah.
Forgotten.
It has a dedicated system that functions as the server. The server responds to the requests made by users or clients connected to it. So that's different. And it has what kind of control? What are some of the advantages of a client-server network over a peer-to-peer?
It has a single administrative control, and it has better security, and it has default backup and storage, central storage.
Yeah, so, that's pretty much it. Okay, let me just go through some of the stuff I've got here. A wireless LAN uses what? What's the media that wireless uses?
Radio waves.
Exactly. Okay, network topologies. Define what? What's a network topology, people? Yeah, Terry, you're right. The layout of a network, either physical or logical, actually both. That's what a topology is. It's both physical and logical layout of a network. So where you're going to put all the components, how the cables are going to be run, and how things are going to be connected, what addresses each one has, and what naming schemes that you're using. Okay. So, logical topologies, we talked about some physical topologies last week, and what were some of those? Yep, Terry, you've got it, you've named all of those, star, bus, mesh, and extended star. And there's one more, can anyone else tell me what it is? It's a ring, you don't see it as often these days, but you'll find it in old mainframe type networks and on some university campuses. Okay, one thing they didn't cover here, which is important, is the difference between a peripheral and a host. Now, that is going right back to the beginning. We talked about what's a peripheral and what's a host and the fact that some devices can be one or the other. What's the difference?
The host is like something like the computer, the router, etc. and the printer is the printer is the peripheral. But if you put your peripheral directly into the router, then it can be a host as well. So the host is sort of like the control, I guess.
What's one characteristic? It doesn't actually... Yes, Terry, peripherals are attached to the host and the hosts are attached to the network. That's the basic difference. And the one rule of thumb that we used in Discovery was that the host usually has an IP address. And that's the big difference between if the printer has an IP address, it's connected to the network and it's a host. If it doesn't, if it's connected to a host, then it's a peripheral. Okay, networking media. What sort of networking media can we have?
We can have cable, coax cable, fiber optic, and radio wave.
And the most common one that you haven't mentioned is?
Ethernet.
And what's the most common Ethernet cable that we use? It is got certain characteristics.
Twisted pair.
Yeah, what kind of twisted pair and why?
Is that the 5E? 5 and 5E cable, which is the twisted pair, to reduce the interference.
You there, Carla?
Yes, yeah, I'm here, sorry. I was talking about, yeah, Kim was right, she said unshielded twisted pair, which is what we were looking for. It's the most common, it's cheaper to install, it's not as good at combating noise and interference. But since we're talking about categories, what are the two things that define a category of UTP cable? There are two things, and it's an exam question. What are they? The number of what and the number of what?
The number of twists and the number of cables.
Not cables. What do you find inside a cable?
Wires.
Fantastic. Okay, the number of wires and the number of twists in those wires. All right. Now, we discussed all those things. Now, the most popular type of LAN architecture and the one that we usually use is what?
DSL.
No, that's a connection technology. We talked about various architectures and the most popular one is starts with E.
Ethernet? No, that's not right.
Yes, it is. Ethernet is right. It's the most common architecture that we use. And it specifies a number of things. The access control method is...
TCIP?
No, that's a protocol. It's that horrible mouthful CSMA / CD. Yeah.
That's that thing with the corruption detection or something.
Collision detection.
Yes. Bang. Yeah. So what it does is it listens for a clear line and then it goes and broadcasts, except if somebody else has listened for a clear line and goes and broadcasts, well, there's a collision and they have to do a jamming algorithm so they can back off, and then there is a protocol which says how much time passes before they try again, and hopefully next time they don't collide, which is a little less efficient than the collision avoidance which wireless uses, but of course, again, we don't need to go into that here. Right. Good old OSI reference model is an industry standard framework that is used to divide the functions of a network into seven what?
Layers.
Yep. And these include what from the top down? Can we remember? Layer seven is?
Application. Something starting with P, which I've forgotten. Session. Transport. Something else I've forgotten. Physical. And I've forgotten something else. Oh, I've left out network somewhere. Application, protocol, session.
Sorry, Terry?
She said the one about sausage pizza goes the other way.
Yes, it does.
Please
it goes
do not
from the
throw
bottom
sausage
up.
Pizza away.
Yeah, and what's the top-down one?
Oh, people seem to need data processing. Good for me.
Yes. Okay. Right. And, of course, you need to compare that with a TCP/IP suite. And we talked about public standards and all kinds of other stuff, but we have come to the end of the session. I think we've all done extremely well. The people who have sat exams and handed in worksheets, the standard is amazing, as it always is. Now, next week you have a break. So there will be no lecture on the 26th of April. And that is because we in this part of the world have Anzac Day clashing with Easter and we have an extra day's holiday. But also it's a good time to give you a breather anyway. So I will meet you all back here on the 3rd of May for Chapter 9, Security. Any questions or comments before we break up? No? Well, everybody have a wonderful Easter. Keep the work rolling in. Read ahead if you want to. And you've all done amazingly well. It's not an easy chapter, this. And we're nearly through the first section of the Cisco course. There's two chapters to go before you can decide to sit a final and move on, and then we can move on to the advanced. Or you can sit your final at the end. But either way, you're making it, folks. You're getting there. So it's all good. Thanks for coming. And I'll be around for any questions if and when necessary. Otherwise, I'll see you all in a fortnight.